I'm Brian McCreath, and this is The Answered Question from WCRB in Boston for November 4th, 2016. This is a podcast of conversations with musicians from the concerts we broadcast each week on WCRB, including this one from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. This is Mozart's 39th Symphony, led by Charles Dutoit last week at Symphony Hall. It was the first part of a program that also included an absolutely riveting performance of Bartok's creepy opera Bluebeard's Castle. The Mozart is available to hear on demand at our website, classicalwcrb.org. Unfortunately, we don't have the rights to offer Bluebeard's Castle on demand, but you can hear it again this coming Monday night, November 7th, as part of our 8 p.m. BSO Encore broadcast. This week, Thomas Otis is the conductor of the BSO concert we'll broadcast live on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And now we can say he's something more than a guest conductor. The Boston Symphony created a new title, Artistic Partner, for him. And on the podcast today, you'll hear about what that means from Thomas Otis himself. Also on the podcast is a conversation with Hugh Wolfe, the director of orchestras at the New England Conservatory, this Sunday at 7 o'clock on WCRB In Concert. I'll bring you the NEC Philharmonia's season-opening performance of Mahler's First Symphony, led by Hugh Wolfe. The interview I have for you today is actually from a few years ago, when Wolfe led the NEC Philharmonia in the American premiere of the original version of Mahler's First, and I think it gives you a lot of background on who Mahler was and how that piece came together. And speaking of WCRB In Concert, last Sunday's broadcast, which featured a Rockport music performance by pianist Vadim Kolodenko, is another one that you can hear on demand. Just go to our website, classicalwcrb.org. When people describe Thomas Otis, it's always as composer, conductor, and pianist. He's extraordinary in all three of those roles, and it's why he and the BSO agreed to a more formal relationship in which Otis has the title Artistic Partner, for at least the next few years. But there's another role that the BSO wisely threw into the mix in this week's program notes for the concert Otis is conducting. He's also a curator. The art of constructing programs is not to be taken lightly, and my experience of Otis in his previous visits to Boston is that he's always thinking about connections among each component on each program he's involved in. This week's program begins with Benjamin Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem, a purely instrumental work inspired by three parts of the Requiem text. After that comes Jean Sibelius's Tapiola, a tone poem that turned out to be the last major piece by the composer. And the second half is a piece Otis himself wrote a few years ago called Totentanz, or Dance of Death. It's inspired by a 15th century frieze at a church in Lübeck, Germany that depicts death, in the form of a skeleton, dancing with people from all walks of life and all parts of society. Along with that visual depiction, there's a poem in medieval German that's essentially a series of conversations between death and each one of those characters. In Totentanz, a mezzo-soprano sings the words of the humans, and a baritone sings the words from death. The connections between Britten's Sinfonia de Requiem and Otis's Totentanz seem pretty clear, at least on the surface, both pieces confronting what we think and feel about death in one way or another. But when I met Thomas Otis after a rehearsal this week at Symphony Hall, I asked him how Sibelius's Tapiola fits into that picture.
Yeah, well, it's not just death. I mean, the Sibelius is his last piece. Very unusually, he then lived for another 30 years. Most composers write the last piece, and that's pretty much it. But it's like there's something like a sort of ultimate statement about this piece, Tapiola. It's like he really got to the core of something, and sort of right into the heart of things, and how all things are one thing, and that's that, you know, it all comes from one melody, and it's got this feeling and of being like the end of the world, and in an interesting way. Like, he writes about the forests of Finland, and the whole feeling of it is it's this endless, unpeopled, wonderful wilderness. And there's the great wind at the end, the great storm, famous storm, which is one of the great bits of orchestral writing. And it feels like the right thing to put in a program about kind of, you know, ultimate destinies and that sort of thing. Of course, my piece, Totentanz, the medieval attitude, was a medieval text, and Dance of Death. They had a kind of much more, almost like a comic attitude to the whole thing. It sounds weird to say so, but there's a certain Halloween horror movie element to it. Like, it's supposed to be entertainment as well as incredibly scary.
Well, I somehow, from our previous conversation when you've been here in the past, have had in mind that Sibelius is actually a really central composer to you. And I somehow have in mind that maybe Britten is too. Can you just mention a word or two about why those two composers, or what role those two composers play in your own sense of artistic identity?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, Britten's our national composer of the 20th century. And I mean, in a piece like this, it's by far the most violent piece of music that anyone in England had written at that time. And he broke a lot of, you know, I suppose, rules in Britten and conventions back in my country, which, you know, even in the 30s was much stuffier, more conservative place in a way than it became. And you know, you had the Second World War, and everything, of course, changed pretty quickly after that. This piece dates from the height of that time, and it really feels like he's writing about the Blitz. And but you know, there's a whole change of sensibility. Right? You know, it's the same time Francis Bacon was starting to paint his scenes of disturbing pictures. I think it belongs in the same world. So I mean, you know, someone like me, my generation, absolutely, we wouldn't be where we are without Britten. And Sibelius as well, you know, was pushing the language of what he could do all the time. So he tends to be, composers always love Sibelius, because you can really hear him thinking. You can hear you know, like in math they say, show the working. Sibelius, you can hear the working, you know, and there's this fantastic sense of, like, what's the word, like a titanic struggle, and like he's hewing material from red hot metal. You can really hear it, like the metal, like a blacksmith, you know. He used that image himself, of course, famously. So I forged another few pages today, sort of thing, and you can hear that. And also the way he gets to this point, especially with this final piece, and you feel he's saying, I can't go any further, because it's like if he'd written another piece, it would be too far ahead of its time. I get the feeling he couldn't go into atonality quite, although gets pretty close, but that wasn't his, in a way, his world. But there was something else, some other way, that he still wasn't kind of quite ready to be discovered. And I, you know, in a way, ask a composer now, they'd say, yeah, you know, I can see carrying on from Tapiola, where he could have gone if he'd lived another 50 years.
That is great, though. I love the idea that that for composers, there's a particular way that you can see the inner workings. So that's really cool. Totentanz, I don't know a lot about the origin of the piece. I know what the piece is based on, this frieze in Lübeck that has been destroyed. But I wonder whether the text of that frieze was something that you had already wanted to set, and this was sort of the opportunity, or did it sort of present itself with the project as it came to you?
I discovered the frieze and the text at the same time in the same book, but standing in that church where, you know, and they had a gift shop, and there was this book. And I'd wanted to, I don't know, I was fascinated by the idea of a medieval text and something, because there's something very uncensored about the medieval texts. You know, things written in the 19th or 18th centuries or 20th, maybe, sometimes they kind of sugarcoat things a little bit, but the medieval text really doesn't. And the actual medieval words that were on the frieze, which the thing was actually made of cloth, so it's quite fragile, had partly got lost. So we got sort of half of it down to us with holes in it. And it's a very, very sort of brilliant, violent, early German, a very ugly language actually, but beautifully ugly. And then they restored it about, you know, 300 years later in 1700 with a much nicer text, like not quite, a bit gentler, like it'll probably be okay as long as you pray and you do this, that sort of tone. So what I did was reconstruct the medieval text using elements of that. So it's like as close as you can get to restoration, like of a painting where there might be a couple of bits where there's something missing. You just fill it in as best you can and in the style. And so it's kind of Anon with a bit of help from me and some very good German-speaking poets.
Well, and so when the idea for a musical piece based on that frieze comes to you, was it something where you saw this work of art in its restored form or the reconstructed, and you had a big picture plan, kind of like, oh, I can do this as a set of voices and messages? Or was it more, I hear some musical ideas, some small musical ideas that I could develop through this kind of art?
I immediately thought, I mean, I think even standing there, looking at the book in the church, I thought, this is for two singers, you know, it's a conversation between one of them, you know, Death, who will be the man, and the human race will be, you know, the soprano. But I think that I didn't even have to think about that. That just sort of came. And the more I looked, I thought, I really, this is going to be my next piece. You know, when you have when that happens, it's a real gift, because you don't have to think for months or years about what I'm going to do next. It's just there in your head, and that's that, you know, you just have to do it. And I think then I went back to London, and I wrote down, the first thing I wrote down was the tune that you hear at the very end, the sound of lullaby. And I sort of just wrote this tune, and it's got to be, this has got, the whole piece has got to get to this point somehow, convincingly. So I hope it does.
Well, and the way that it gets there is through these characters. You have Death, and you have all these people, these characters, yeah, who represent those people we see around us every day. Are there some of those characters that took longer to sort of figure out how to voice them, how to structure the textural part around them, you know, more than some others? Were there some characters that came very easily to you?
Trying to remember which were the easy ones, which are the hard ones. They vary a lot in length, you know. I mean, the Pope is given a lot of time, the Emperor. They probably get sort of, and then as he, you know, because Death speaks to each character in the way that they'd understand, so in a way, in their own language slightly, because he only exists because of them, in a way as well. Because they die. So he gives the Pope a very good talking to, and then as he gets down, he likes to cut these very powerful people down to size, but then as he gets further down into the sort of middle classes, as we'd call now, that, you know, the doctors, the usurer, and the mayor, this kind of character, he's got little time for these people, because they're ambitious, and the whole point about Death is he's no respecter of ambition or status at all. That's the whole point. So he swats them like flies, one after the other, very quickly. Some of them almost happen at the same time. It's really, no, next. He literally says to the doctor, next, like he would in the waiting room of the surgery. And then there's a sort of thunderous climax, which is after the merchant, and that it sort of was my, I suppose, idea. I mean, it just happened that was the point of the piece where I needed to have the whole ton of bricks fall on top of one of the characters, and it ended up being the merchant, because I suppose also you could say that the merchant is to our world today what the Pope was in medieval, like everything, it's all powerful, you know, money is all powerful. So I don't know whether that's true or not, but I just had this, that's the way it turned out. And then you immediately go from that to these people who are the working class, I suppose, you know, like it's the guy who opens, who unlocks the church door, and, you know, and then there's the craftsman, which is a self-portrait. it's kind of, so it's like all of it, it sounds like all of his sculptures or whatever he is supposed to make are kind of melting wax in the face of Death. It's all quite macabre, really. And then, and those ones, that they get a bit longer at that point, because it all starts to slow down gradually towards the final character, of course, who's the child, the baby, actually. And the baby is two things. He's at once, he is a baby, but he's also everybody, because everybody was a baby. You know, we all have been babies. So there's two aspects to it. And so it's really like kind of, like we were saying in the Sibelius, like kind of aiming towards one sole point on which the whole pyramid is kind of balanced, and it gets right to this sort of final point. That was the way it worked out.
That's fantastic. I love that. Your beginning, as I mentioned, your position here as artistic partner. And just very quickly, I wonder what it is about this situation that you've constructed with the BSO that made this really something you wanted to devote time to? Because this will take up a significant part of your schedule for the next few years anyway. What opportunities did you see here that you really thought, this is so attractive, I really want to pursue this?
Well, I mean, actually, you know, I've been coming here more or less once a year. I mean, give or take. Not, you know, there was no plan to it, and every time I'm here, I love it. I love the orchestra, and I just can't. There's many reasons why I just find it so easy and rewarding to work here with them. I mean, you know, and then I thought, well, if we simply give it a name and a kind of shape. And I will be here a little bit more, which is good. But it's essentially it's just naming something that was already naturally occurring. So that's. But also, if it's a, I think a 3-year is the idea, 3-year span. And of course, that means that when you're planning what to do, you can see beyond the end of, as it were, next visit, next week. You can sort of see a bit further, and. You know, I mean, I'm not going to be sort of telling anyone, let's do this, let's do that. That's not my place at all. I just feel I will do my thing, and we'll, the symphony will do theirs. And I think they'll, so as they have been so far, will coincide very happily. Plus, there'll be Tanglewood, which I'm looking forward to enormously. Very excited about going there.
Yeah. Have you been to Tanglewood?
First sort of one day in 1991. So I was very... I was 20 years old, and it made an. In fact, it was the first place I went in the United States. As it happens, it just, you know, I'm from New York. It kept coming from New York and then straight to Tanglewood, and so I remember thinking, you know, as an English person, might, this is so huge, you know. So it just, I had to get my. So that's a memory, but it was also the extraordinary combination of people that you met there, not just of course the brilliant students, but these people from the highest kind of history of music, like, you know, I met Louis Krasner, who premiered the Berg Violin Concerto with Webern conducting. You know, this is kind of, I mean, you know, it was, even now I kind of think, did that really happen? But it did really happen.
And when Thomas Addis comes to Tanglewood next summer, he'll perform as a pianist with the Emerson String Quartet in a program made up of works by Schubert and Mark Anthony Turnage. And he'll lead the Tanglewood Music Center in music by Sibelius and by himself. And he'll conduct the BSO in another one of his own pieces, along with one of the pieces we'll hear this week, Britten's Sinfonia da Requiem and Beethoven's Emperor Concerto with soloist Emmanuel Ax. Complete details about the 2017 Tanglewood season are set to be announced later this month, and you'll hear about them here on The Answered Question. In the meantime, you'll hear the Boston Symphony program Thomas Addis was just talking about tomorrow night, live from Symphony Hall at 8 o'clock, on the radio in Boston at 99.5 FM, and streaming online at classicalwcrb.org. WCRB in Concert is our relatively new program on Sunday nights at 7, with concerts from across Boston and New England. And this Sunday we have a performance from the New England Conservatory, including a couple of pieces performed at the First Monday concert on October 3rd, and the season opening performance by the NEC Philharmonia with conductor Hugh Wolfe. At First Monday concerts, which, as you might guess, happen on the first Monday of each month, NEC faculty get together for chamber music in a series curated by cellist and former NEC president Lawrence Lesser. The NEC Philharmonia is the top orchestra at the conservatory, and in their season opening concert, they played Mahler's First Symphony. A few years ago, Hugh Wolfe conducted the American premiere of the original version of Mahler 1, which has some really fascinating aspects that can tell us a lot about Mahler. So with this year's Mahler 1 performance on the air Sunday, it seems like a good time to revisit a conversation I had with Hugh Wolfe at that time about that earlier performance. Before we get into this specific version of Mahler's First Symphony, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about Mahler at this particular time, and maybe you can set a scene for us about where he was in his life when he began to tackle his First Symphony, and I imagine then later might even be a different time when he managed to get it premiered.
He was more of an opera conductor starting out his career, a young man in his 20s. He started writing the symphony, we think, in 1884. At the time, he was kind of assistant opera conductor in Kassel, Germany, a medium-sized town, not very good conditions. He was not happy there. He went on to Prague for a couple of years, also as a kind of assistant or a second conductor. And then he ended up in Budapest, where he got a position as the head of the opera. And Budapest was a very important city in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And it was there in 1889, a piece that he'd probably written most of 4 or 5 years earlier, he finally had the kind of the guts as a conductor, more than a composer, known as a conductor, and hired there to be a conductor. He brought it out of his out of his briefcase and said, "Let's play this piece." In fact, the orchestra there asked him, "Do you have a piece you would like us to play? We would like to play a piece of yours," because he was known as a composer, but not primarily. And so that was his chance, finally, 5 years after he wrote most of it, to actually hear it.
And so two ways of looking at it. Does the symphony in any way reflect Mahler's own personal life and circumstances, and or does it reflect the time in which he wrote it in society and culture?
I think it's hard to answer the first part of that question. I think all of his music reflects his psychological and emotional makeup, and all of his music is certainly of that time. He was, like all symphonists, with big ambitions to write big symphonies. Brahms and Bruckner, I think, were his models at this time. He was trying to expand what the symphony was and what the symphony meant and what a symphony could do. And even in this first symphony, which at the 1889 premiere, he didn't call it Symphony No. 1. He called it Symphonic Poem in Two Parts. So he was experimenting with the idea of is it a symphony or isn't it a symphony? Does it break the rules of what a symphony should look like structurally? Is it trying to express and encompass ideas and feelings that were beyond what symphonies did? And I think the answer is yes to all those questions. And so this, as a 24-year-old composer, 29-year-old when it was finally premiered, yeah, this was his attempt to push the envelope of what the symphony was at the end of the 19th century.
Okay, so he's 29 years old. He has ambitions in terms of what it is a symphony can do, or a large-scale symphonic work, even if we're not going to call it a symphony. Is there a way that we can say that Mahler was most interested in making his mark as a composer or more interested in making his mark as a conductor?
I think he probably felt that his legacy was going to be composition. I think most composers who are also performers feel that way, that composition is where you will achieve immortality. Conducting or performing is good that night and maybe good for the next month or so, but you know, your legacy is what you leave behind. This was before the era of recording, so clearly what he left behind was what he wrote down. And I think even though if one probably took the entire span of his life and added up the number of hours he spent composing and the number of hours he spent working in the opera house, the latter probably exceeded the former. I think he was extremely busy as a conductor, worked incredibly hard, was passionate about every performance, spent all the winter season months in the opera house, and did most of his composing in the few summer months from, let's say, May to September when he had free time.
I actually was really lucky to see this opera house in Budapest where this piece was premiered. And these days, maybe we think of Budapest because of the legacy of the Iron Curtain as being kind of backwater, way off the beaten trail. But this opera house is spectacular. And so as a 29-year-old conductor coming in to run this place, I mean, it must have been something that was a golden opportunity for him. As I understand it, this was second only to the Vienna Opera House in terms of its magnificence, in terms of its opulence. What do we know about that night? What was it that happened that night when he took the podium and actually took the orchestra through this massive piece of music?
Well, it's interesting, and it's hard to know because there are records that say that he was pleased with the rehearsals and he complimented the orchestra on their hard work. But there are also letters or records that seem to indicate that there may have been a little bit of sabotage and that the players didn't really respond to the music and that they didn't necessarily bring it to life quite the way he expected it to. And as is so often the case with geniuses and their first works or their first attempts at works, it was panned by the critics. It was given a really pretty dreadful treatment by the critics, and I think right away he withdrew it and started rewriting it. Virtually the next day, I think, he was rewriting it. And I think we can assume that he was rewriting it in the rehearsal period prior as well. And knowing what we know about Mahler and the rest of his life, he spent a lot of time revising all his works. He never stopped revising them. He was the ultimate practical performer, and at every performance he learned something about what works and doesn't work. And he would take notes and change the piece accordingly, sometimes just out of practical considerations. If he had players who weren't capable of a certain passage, he might change it at any given performance. So whatever's written down as the, you know, this is the final version, that's in a sense nonsense with Mahler, because he was always changing.
I managed to catch just a little bit of your rehearsal today, and even just the few notes I heard, the differences are stark right mm-hmm. away. But mm-hmm. is there a way that in a nutshell you can summarize just a few of the major differences between what we'll hear in this concert and what people normally hear when they see Mahler's First Symphony on a schedule?
Yeah, the First Symphony that you normally hear is 4 movements long. This is 5 movements long. There's a small second movement called Blumine, which is sometimes performed today separately, that was part of the 5-movement symphonic poem in 1889. The other 4 movements, with the exception of the last movement, you will, in a sense, hear from beginning to end exactly what the musical skeleton, the musical structure, it's all there, kind of bar for bar. There are very, very small differences in the actual structure, except in the last movement, of the other movements. The orchestration is radically different. And so what instruments are playing the tune, how they're balanced, how they're used, all of that's very different. It's a much smaller orchestra. It's an orchestra the size of a Brahms symphony. Whereas by the time he finished revising the First Symphony, he had 40 non-string players, 40 winds, brass, percussion. We have just over 20. So the orchestra that he used, the winds and brass, doubled in size as he revised it, giving him many, many more opportunities for combinations of sounds. This is a much more austere orchestration, so that you might notice. And then finally, and perhaps most interesting and most important, is there's about 5 minutes of music in the last movement that, as far as we know, no one has heard since 1889. No one, anywhere in the world. So this has been reconstructed from a manuscript that exists, that is in his hand and a copyist's hand, that has the date of the 1889 premiere written in the manuscript. So we think there's a good chance he may have even conducted from this manuscript. It went through the hands of his brother-in-law's son. It's in a library in a university in Canada, at University of Western Ontario in London, Ontario. It sat there, and it was discovered less than 20 years ago as being what it probably is, an authentic manuscript from that day. And it has lain unperformed because of, I think, just the gigantic task of taking a manuscript and making orchestra parts out of it, which is the task we undertook this summer.
I was just going to say, you undertook this task.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And so here's a question. Are you more surprised by what Mahler took out, or are you more surprised by what Mahler left into the symphony?
I think what's striking is how much of it is Mahler Symphony No. 1, actually. I mean, it really is the piece. You will recognize everything. With the one exception in the finale, where the finale has always had structural problems. You can see that Mahler slaved over it. It gave him real issues. He never really, I think, found the way that was definitive to make the structure of that movement work. And here in his first attempt, you hear some strikingly beautiful, strikingly original, and even strange music that got cut, that ended up on the cutting room floor. For me, that's the biggest thrill, is to be playing 5 minutes of Mahler that no one's heard before.
You say that Mahler's First is Mahler's first, even in this version, but is there something that arrives to the performers or the audience in your speculation about what people will hear that is a different experience? Is there a way that this piece comes to us differently from the version that we normally hear?
I hope so. I have to say that what we're doing is a slight hybrid. The manuscript that I referred to from 1889 contains only 3 of the 5 movements. So the little Blumine movement and the famous Frère Jacques funeral march movement, for those 2 movements, we're using the oldest known edition, which is 1893, also different considerably from what you hear in the modern performance. In modern performance, you don't hear the second movement at all, and the orchestration of the funeral march is quite different. So I think that you will experience in listening to five movements, all of which are orchestrated different from what you're used to, and which take us on a slightly different journey. I think those three inner movements with the movement added give us a different shape and a different feel. And I think the adventure of finding your way through a whole new kind of forest of trees and flowers and hills in the last movement is pretty thrilling. So if you come with open ears, you'll hear a piece you know well, and at the same time, you'll be hearing a whole new experience, a whole new adventure wrapped around a piece you know well.
And you've chosen to program along with this Don Juan by Richard Strauss, premiered just around the same time. So what is it that you have personally sort of found in putting these pieces next to each other, rehearsing the orchestra with these pieces next to each other? Do either of them, even with all the differences of the Mahler, come across to you differently than they did before?
Yes, and it was striking to me, that was the genesis of this program. Don Juan was premiered November 11, 1889 in Weimar. 9 days later, November 20 in Budapest, Mahler's symphonic poem in two parts. They didn't really know each other. They obviously were not able to attend each other's premieres. They got to know each other shortly thereafter. Strauss was 24, Mahler was 29. The most striking thing perhaps is that Strauss was clearly a kind of Mozart-sized prodigy, that this is a fully formed, mature work, dare I say it, at the age of 24. And Mahler, 5 years older, is still finding his way. So in some ways, the more sophisticated work is the Strauss, the composer that, for my tastes, ended up having sort of more to say and more that kind of resonates with us in the 21st century was Mahler. It took him 20 years. Strauss, in a way, was the prodigy who 20 years later was writing more and more conservative operas and then kind of lived off his laurels after Mahler's death. So their trajectories were quite different. At this point, clearly Strauss was the hottest thing going. Mahler was more of an opera conductor experimenting with presenting his symphonic works to the world. 20 years later, things were different.
You said that Mahler, you feel like, has probably more to say to us in our 21st century world. And you're dealing with a group of students who are, you know, barely born before the beginning of the 21st mm-hmm. century. Mm-hmm. Some of them may have played Mahler's first before, but I'm guessing many of them haven't. What do you find in the reaction of your students in the NEC Philharmonia to this piece of music?
I think it's fascinating because you say quite a few may not have played it. I don't know. I think quite a few have played it and everybody's heard it. And so it was actually very difficult to train our ears not to play what we already knew, but to play what we saw in front of us. Not just the orchestrational differences, but the differences in dynamics, the differences in the scope, the size of the orchestra, the amount of sound. So to kind of scale things to what we actually were seeing in front of us, as opposed to automatically playing what we'd heard, what we knew. And that's been a real challenge, because you have to realize that dynamics are different, shapes are different, phrases go different places, things that are fortissimo in this version ended up piano in the later version and vice versa. So there's a lot where your ear and your experience and your memory have to be discarded, and you have to think, okay, this is fresh, I've never played this before.
It says a lot about modern music education that you have 19 and 20-year-olds who have played Mahler's first.
Well, Mahler is, as you say, kind of, he is of our time for some reason. You know, the kind of the intensity, the neurosis, the jumble of all experiences packed into an hour, it speaks to us. And a lot of people have listened and played a lot of Mahler.
Do you feel like this version of Mahler's First Symphony has prospects for further performance in other venues as more than a sort of novelty?
I hope so. I think that obviously it's a musicological experiment. From a musicologist's point of view, it's absolutely thrilling and exciting. I wouldn't think that every performance of Mahler 1 should go in this direction. But the fact that we've put in the work, that it's now there, let the scholars, let the performers decide. We put in a lot of work, so we're happy to rent the parts if we're allowed to do that. I don't know. We got permission from Mahler's granddaughter to proceed with this whole project, so it's just been a labor of love. And if it if people are interested and it takes off, I wouldn't be surprised and I'd be very happy.
Well, there are times when some conductors have decided to go ahead and throw in the Blumenau movement with the later version of Mahler 1. Maybe now they'll consider this as their alternative if that's really what they want to do.
That's right. And there is the 1893 manuscript. 4 years later, the performance in Hamburg, his first full revision. In his hand, he completely revised it, slightly expanded the orchestra. That version has been performed and recorded. I think once in the 70s it was recorded. So that's out there. So now you've got a lot to choose from.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot, Hugh Wolf.
Thank you.
And that original version of Mahler's First Symphony is available to hear on demand when you visit our website, classicalwcrb.org. Look for the NEC Philharmonia at In Concert, and you'll see a link there. And tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. to hear Mahler's First Symphony as performed by the NEC Philharmonia earlier this fall, along with performances from NEC's First Monday series. Remember, you can subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes or through your favorite podcast app, and you can also find TAQ at WCRB's Facebook, Twitter, and SoundCloud feeds. Thanks to Thomas Addis and Hugh Wolf and the staffs of the Boston Symphony and the New England Conservatory. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.